Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I want to welcome you to tonight's special Solari Report, a two-hour briefing with Clifford Carnicom of the Carnicom Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the leading researcher on the phenomena referred to as the global spraying programs, including what is referred to sometimes as chemtrails. Clifford joined us on the Solari Report on May 20th. The response was so positive, and their request for, please, just much more detail was so strong that we decided to organize this special event. We've never done a sort of two-hour special, but there's always a first time, and Clifford, you're it. We're testing new access software for this event. This will allow you to post your questions live while we are speaking. So I've collected your questions from the cart, More Great Questions, and I'll be watching them live if you want to type them in if you're using the web software. Anyway, so let's see how this works. If the software works, we plan to use it more often. I'm also going to be posting links as we speak. Clifford is going to be giving us links as for future reference, and I'll be posting them on a very timely basis on the blog post at solari.com/blog that describes this event. So it's a special Solari report. And so if you have trouble understanding the links and you want to check them, just I'll keep refreshing them at the blog post. So Clifford, thank you so much for taking the time to join us again.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and thanks for the experiment. I like experiments.
Well, we're not going to repeat the wonderful interview you did on May 20th, but you gave, at that time, you introduced your seven areas of research, and what we're going to do tonight is go through each one of them and go in much more detail than we could the last time you joined us, and so maybe if I could ask you to introduce those seven areas as an introduction, and then we'll just dive right in.
Sure. Thanks very much, Catherine. This list evolved as a course of research, it wasn't premeditated. In other words, each topic arose as a result of investigations that took place. And the list includes the following. The first would be that of environmental modification and control, of which weather modification would be a part or a subset of that. This is the one that has received in many ways the most public attention, I suppose. The second would be, and these aren't necessarily in the order we would take them tonight, but the second would be those of biological operations. That has become increasingly important and has occupied the majority of my time over the last 3 or 4 years out of the dozen years or sort of so total that have been dedicated to this. The third would be that of electromagnetic aspects, changes to the atmosphere particularly, and from an electromagnetic point of view. The fourth would be the likely conduct of military operations. The fifth would be, and from here on we start to get a little bit more conceptual and more based upon analytics rather than hard data, because we don't have it as much, but some data. And that would be geophysical modification, the actual consideration is whether or not the planet itself could be altered with changes of energy. And the next to last one would be that of the development or consideration of development of a surveillance system on a different type of level than that which we might be accustomed to. And the last would be having to do with the detection of energy sources and energy disturbances within the atmosphere, and that would relate to consideration of propulsion systems and unusual or exotic propulsion systems and energy systems. And that would be probably the most conceptual at all in terms of the data that's available, and we'll probably spend the least amount of time on that.
Okay.
But nevertheless, worthy of mention, that's for sure.
Well, let's dive in. Why don't we start with environmental modification and control? And if you could also describe sort of your history, I guess that's the area you started with, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's, you know, the the alteration, the physical alteration of the atmosphere and a documentation of that through photography was the first phase of the work, just simply visually recording what was happening and calling attention to the fact that something seemed unusual and also wrong as far as that goes. And then it would have progressed into chemical studies and environmental studies, sampling of the environment, that type of thing. But certainly the first part of the work did focus on alterations just to the physical environment, what was taking place through that sequence.
And what have you found is the impact on the environment so far?
Well, it's quite significant. I think that, you know, I tend to work from a large scale, sort of a macro view first, and then as the need arises, then I will dig into those details to whatever level is necessary and that I'm capable of doing or have the resources to. And so I think what I would do here is give that big picture first in terms of what I see in relation to the weather, and then we could dig in, you know, into the detail as we would like to. But, you know, this environmental or weather control issue has certainly, I think, received the most attention with respect to this issue, maybe for several reasons. One would be that it's the easiest to see in terms of people's experience and life. If they start to notice change in the weather that seems very unusual to them, if they start to notice changes in their visibility, what they can see, and their storms and this type of thing, that would be one reason. The other might be actually more by design. In other words, it is certainly possible, and not unreasonable, that certain explanations were offered to the public in an attempt to explain their concern or worry. And it would appear to me that most of those explanations centered around weather, and in particular, the global warming hypothesis came up quite strongly. And it was quite interesting in that really from the beginning, without any real basis or reason for it offered, there was a scenario presented that whatever is happening, whatever changes that people are seeing on a grand scale, that implicitly it essentially must be good for us, and it has something to do with this global warming thing, and it must be helping us
out. So the theory was it was protecting us from the sun.
Yes, and or the, you know, the common idea of global warming, that the planet is heating up, and this somehow must be doing something good for it. But that was never, the source of that was never framed. The ideas of it and the logic behind it was never presented, and it was always sort of just kept undercover in the sense that, well, it must be that way, but you're not really to know about it. And so quite a bit of airtime and promotion has been given to that thesis, and that bothered me in a sense of, first of all, for the reasons that I mentioned, but increasingly it bothered me because it didn't fit. The observations did not fit the explanations that were being given. The observations that I was accruing over several years were in direct opposition to the claims that this was somehow cooling the planet. And I kept quiet for really a very long time because it's hard to get that kind of picture of a global change, you know, a global warming model.
Well, how long did it take you to realize that the spring was going on globally, that it was a global phenomenon?
Oh, I would say that recognition would take place within the first year or two. My work started in 1999, the beginning of 1999. So I would certainly think within a couple of years it was apparent to me. Particularly reports were starting to come in that were dealing with global operation, and then I would start to look at it from that standpoint. And, you know, many, many people interpret things locally and regionally, and they would like to think that only their particular area is being affected, but the atmosphere is what you call a fluid medium. In other words, it will seek an equilibrium over time. It's not really any different than the water in your bathtub if you were to color it with some dye or something. Eventually that will distribute itself. And the atmosphere is the same in principle. And looking at it from that standpoint, it was apparent to me that given enough time and given enough change in saturation, that's exactly what would happen to the planet. And the notion or idea that I would have some particular safe refuge diminished or weakened pretty much directly in accordance with the length of the operations. So,
right.
So, you know, I would say there was a problem developing, and in that the work was showing that this really isn't matching. The observations and the chemistry is actually indicating that the materials that are being put in the atmosphere are actually heating up the atmosphere rather than cooling it down. And this was in direct opposition. In fact, I have to regard myself as a lone wolf at that point, because no one would really say that. And I say things because I have to, not necessarily because I want to. And this has happened many, many times. And that finally did come out in my work, that I said, sorry, this is what I see. And it's in direct opposition to this claim, and therefore the whole idea as to why that particular story is being presented to us as being so strong, and then the fact that it was basically an implicit or a covert explanation bothered me even more, and the science carried on. I would say that, you know, from this environmental viewpoint that we're starting with, there would be three or four main factors that are altered from a planetary sense with respect to weather based upon observation and analysis. And the first would be that of a change in the heat quotient of the Earth. And my work would indicate that this actually heats up the Earth rather than cools it down. And eventually, you know, if we look, we'll find that I did develop a global warming model. It took several years to get to that point, but I did it. And the work was done in a very conservative fashion. And the end conclusion of that work is that the impact of these particular aerosols they are anticipated to match in magnitude any known or purported claims of global warming that are documented, okay, in terms of the actual measurable change of temperature. That these aerosols are equal, if not greater, in impact to that effect. The second would be the changes and effects upon moisture. Certainly a very common observation that came really in a very general sense from across all locations was that it was noticed these operations would often, if not usually, precede storms. And that became a significant point over time in my analysis, first of all, because it showed itself to be true. And then you had to start looking at the interaction with moisture. And the third would be instability in the weather, what you call a thermal instability, and reasons for that. A fourth one would be changes in the pH of the rainfall. That was one of my first grassroots nationwide network experiments, where I solicited recordings from people across the nation in addition to my own, tried to get some kind of sense as to whether or not what I was measuring was extended beyond my location in Santa Fe. And it was rather interesting because it showed a rather strong case of alteration in the acidity and alkaline environment of the rainfall. And, you know, these things we're talking about, you know, these are not trivial issues.
Right.
If you start to put these all together, you're talking about literally changing the environmental state of the Earth in terms of certainly.
So you're changing the air, you're changing the soil.
That's right, and eventually, you know, and then many people would try to confine this to the atmosphere, but in the end we can't because it comes down. Now, there's plenty of folks out there, or at least let's call it a noted few, that would say, you know, it doesn't really matter where it is and it'll never come down and it's not relevant. It's not true in the eventual sense. You can get away with that argument for a little while, but this stuff will come down. There are ways of determining that rate of descent, and you're basically dealing with particle size, and it will vary anywhere from basically hours to weeks to months to years. But it will come down, and you therefore have to look at that aggregate impact upon the soil and upon the water and eventually upon the biology of the planet. You know, the atmosphere is an envelope. So the last one would be, I would say at this point that I would throw out, would be the electrical nature of the atmosphere and how it's changed, and then that'll throw us into the, you know, electromagnetic stuff that
right.
we get going. But these are all areas that, you know, I have researched, and people will judge for themselves as to whether or not they think my research is sound or valid. Let's just say that I had no intention of spending, you know, a dozen years of my life digging into this stuff for, let's call it, amusement. It's done out of need for the public benefit. This is where it comes from. And, you know, the consumption of energy that has been required here because of the lack of proper and appropriate and adequate response is just, it's overwhelming in terms of the energy that has to be applied in it. And my general theme along the whole dozen years is basically to call attention to the matter and then directly ask for involvement. You know, you do not go conducting global environmental impact studies by a single individual. That's not the way.
Right, on a volunteer, one nights and weekends.
That's right. You just don't do that in terms of sensible way. But I've done what I can at least to get things started for us. And
well, it's extraordinary. I mean, if you go to Carnegie Mellon Institute or your other websites, it's extraordinary what you've managed to achieve just on a volunteer basis.
As I'm looking at these papers, you know, the subjects we're talking about tonight, I get amazed myself in terms of what was actually done at that point, because this business of the environmental side, I'm seeing that most of that work was done in the time frame from roughly 2001 to 2005. You know, so we're talking about 8 years,
right?
8 to 12 years ago, primary work was done, and it's actually quite a reflection for me as well to look upon these papers at that time and see what was done at that time and, you know, how they have evolved into our current state of knowledge.
While you were doing this, I was researching all the money that started to go missing from the federal government in October 98, which is the beginning of the 1990 fiscal year. And one of the things I always ask, you know, as I was driving around looking at this spraying going on all across the country was, who's paying for this? You know, this is a very expensive operation. This is not cheap. And what's interesting is it starts and really develops as the money is going missing. And you see an explosion in what I call the black budget in the federal government. And one of my theories of all the fixes that happened after 9/11 is it moved a lot of the black budget on budget. But clearly somebody is paying a great deal. I mean, this is funded at the U.S. government and meta-government level. This is a very big financial commitment, but if you look at all the money disappearing and the financial fraud going on, it's absolutely feasible that this could be funded.
And we know that it has to be at some point. You know, it's also amazing what's public and what's not public. I remember an article, and we can always dig these up if we want to, but I remember an article, you know, somewhere probably 6-7 years ago, I would guess, something like that. And it's just this proclamation, and it's something to the effect, you know, my numbers can be off a little bit, but we'll dig it, but it was something to the effect of, you know, that roughly it's like 20 or 25% of the defense budget is completely unaccounted for, okay?
Right.
They simply do not have any accounting for it. And these things, you know.
There was one year where the $2.3 trillion was unaccounted for, which was bigger than the entire budget.
Yeah.
So that was more than 100%.
And these things just pass by, right? It's just a momentary news item. and it's like, you know, the next day another news item's in it. And it's like, whoa, okay, do you realize what was just stated here? Okay. And
well,
that's in a public sense. That's in a public sense.
So, well, if you want to do a global weather control program, the funding has been organized and arranged to do it. There's, you know, from a financial standpoint, everything you're saying is absolutely feasible from a financial standpoint, given the way the money's been organized for the last 20 years. So let's go into biological operations. Tell us about that, because I know that's where you've been spending a lot more of your time recently.
It is, and, you know, it's probably the last 4 to 5 years now that the work has evolved to that. Again, it's not something, again, that I particularly wanted to do, but it has evolved that way. And if I look back at the record at this, and there's always this origin, and if you look back at this biological issue, it also traces back to 2001. It's amazing. Within 1 to 2 years after the work started, there was the emergence of some very unusual things going on with respect to biology that I was finding and reporting. And
so there was literally stuff in the spring, in the spring.
Here's how it starts. I mean, if you take back the first case of this, it was in May in 2000 is when it is. And what happens here is that you have some filament material, fibrous material that's airborne, that's collected by an individual on his way up to Alaska, And it's large enough that it lands on the highway in sort of a ribbon form and on his fender of his car. And so he photographs it. And he was planning, in fact, he did. I take that up to Alaska University to try to get this identified. And I had been, May 2000, I'd been into a little bit over a year, and my name was out there sufficiently to where he knew I was at least interested in airborne samples. And so he sent me some of that sample. And, you know, I started my work just from a sheer physical analysis. We may have talked about that a little bit last time. But I studied this material intensively, and just from a physical standpoint, I mean, sure, by size and by properties and makeup, this filament material was highly unusual. It just was. A hair is 60 to 100 microns in thickness. An asbestos fiber is about 2 microns in thickness. So that'll give you some sense of scale. These filaments that we're talking about were sub-micron in thickness.
Wow.
Now, if you
were, so
if,
these
you know,
are the same filaments that you see in Morgellons disease.
Well, and it ends up that there is, an amazing correspondence that takes place eventually. But, you know, I receive these filaments, and I'm doing my work just from a sheer standpoint of physically showing people what's going on. Unbeknownst to me, at the time I'm looking at this, there is a medical person that has also some of the same sample. I'm not aware of this at the time. And I get a letter from this person several months after I had posted my papers. And this individual says, Clifford, I'd like to come down and have you meet with me because I'm seeing some things that you're not able to see with your equipment. And so I go down and visit him, and he has a very high-quality microscopes. And we spend the afternoon together, and I'm able to see some things that there's no way I would begin to see with the equipment I had. And what I'm seeing are biological, I call them biological components at this point. Person is trying to figure them out. Now, I will tell you at this time, this was, we'd have to look at my date. My next date that I come out is in May 2001. Right. May 2001. Well, this stuff is happening probably in 1999, this particular case. So he tells me there's biologicals. Now, this particular case, he's a medical professional. I'm not at liberty to state his name. It's just the way it was. It was the agreement. But this individual has nothing to do with me. He starts telling me, he says, these are erythrocytes. These are a form of an erythrocyte or a red blood cell. And he tells me they appear to be desiccated, equivalent to what would be freeze-drying. And what he's been spending on his time on is a process of trying to discover how to reconstitute these, to turn these things to full shape and form. And this is what I was seeing while I was there. At the same time that all this was going on, you had the same material.
So basically what we have is we have desiccated red blood cells being
It was in the fiber samples, and this is absolutely...
Okay.
It's absolutely bizarre at that time, right? It's beyond comprehension that this is what's going on at this point. I had nothing to do with it.
If you'd worked in the Bush administration with me, you'd know that nothing is beyond comprehension.
Well, that's right. We know that now. But I post the photograph from the video session, and I put the individual's testimony and account up there. Well, it's a year or two later, whenever it is, when I'm starting to do my studies, and I'm starting to improve my equipment and such, that I start seeing something. And it catches my attention because erythrocytes, your red blood cells, have a very unique geometry in terms of their biconcavity. You just don't find that kind of structure.
Right.
It's just not out there. And I start finding the structure, and it's at the limit of what I can see. I start digging into this problem, and it ends up that I validate this person's work from a couple years ago, and I put it out there, and I'm saying, you know, sort of like the looks like a duck, quacks like a duck. It's like, I do not understand how this can be, but this is what I'm seeing, and I start putting the photographs up. The photographs
right.
at that point are, we could call it somewhat marginal in terms of my equipment that I had, and they weren't real clear, but I did the best that I could. I received a tremendous amount of criticism for posting that information up there in the sense that, you know, this is off the deep end, and this is absurd. How could it be? But then you will find, if you look at this biological issue, you will find a chronology that starts in that early years, you know, literally 2000 or so, progresses through the early 2000 years with the repeated discovery of this particular erythrocytic form, freeze-dried form. And then around 2005, somewhere in there, 2007, 2008, this Morgellons topic emerges. And I started digging into that. And then eventually, over time, if you
why
follow
you
this research,
this? Not everybody on the call understands what Morgellons is.
Yeah, well, okay, thank you. Let's mention, first of all, you had an individual who coined the term for a particular condition because of the lack of any kind of medical response for it, apparently, is what had happened. I once met with a medical doctor on this, and he said this condition will always have a problem in terms of acceptance because the patient is not allowed to name the disease. And so the term is going to be problematic from point number one.
Actually, it was a mother whose child, the doctors
right.
were saying, this can't be, this isn't, and so the parent named the disease Morgellons disease.
That's right. But you have this situation where individuals are starting to report filaments emerging from their skin. And it's a physical thing. They can see it. And then you have the...
Kind of like little wires that grow in your body.
I mean, the counterclaim would be that this is just the hair. And there was always a counterclaim from day one in my research that everything is normal. Just do not be concerned. Everything is always normal, no matter what it is. And then it gets to the point where these people from different locations, you know, they're showing these symptoms of these filaments, and the counterclaim is it's just fine, it's normal, it's just a hair. But then if you start studying these in detail under the microscope and you actually compare them with some kind of rigor, you'll find that they're not a hair. And then if you study them in great detail, then you start to find out that these filaments have a great deal of complexity to them. They're not simple at all. And
What are they made of? What do they consist of?
My work indicates four stages. Other people may have their own work, but I can only do with, you know, what I see and what I record. And my work on the Morgellons issue indicates four stages of growth or composition. And two of them would be in the, I have to call it bacterial-like. There's nothing that matches exactly anything that's known that I can find or that anyone else can identify. But two of the four have what I call a bacterial-like quality to them in terms of their size and shape and this type of thing, growth. The third would be this housing structure, which is the filament, okay? What people see as a filament, to me, this is not, let's call it
the growing. It looks to me remarkably like what the filament they're putting in the currency.
Well, I'd have to analyze that currency to see. I don't know, but these have different characteristics that are identifiable, certainly in terms of their measurements and this type of thing. So what most people would regard as the primary structure or this filament, to me, I'm regarding as simply a housing structure. It looks like the transport and the housing structure composed primarily of protein, amazingly similar. It's quite interesting the twist you get into. But appears to be amazingly similar to the protein in hairs, okay? Keratin, like what's in your fingernails, incredibly tough, very hard. I even had a lab analysis one time that indicated this keratin. But what it doesn't tell is what's going on inside. It's what's inside of these filaments that has occupied me. And that's three out of the four. And the fourth would be the presence of this erythrocytic structure. And this is where it really gets very strange, because it just doesn't fit, okay, in terms of any kind of conventional or known biology by any means. But these are the four stages of growth that I see. My work is at the point where this
now, these are, I'm assuming these are human red blood cells?
Well, I can't say that. All I can say is they match. I'll say they match the size. But we're going to need more distinctive tests to make those kinds of those kind of determinations. I can identify it the best that I can. I always say, if you can prove me wrong, do it. But, I've gone so far as to get into hemoglobin tests, forensic hemoglobin tests, and it passed these tests. I have three tests that it passed for a determination of an erythrocyte the best I can. This business of being freeze-dried or desiccated is an extremely important aspect of what goes on. There's something about these in their originating form, which is much smaller. It doesn't match the normal size. But when they are reconstituted in an appropriate environment, that's what that other doctor was doing some time ago and that I have experimented with. But if you reconstitute it, a saline environment, basically trying to approximate the human body, seems to be suitable. But they will reconstitute to full shape, size, and form I have scores and scores of photographs under the microscope of everything that we are speaking of here tonight. I know it sounds extreme and outlandish, and I'm not out to instill fear, but I do report what I see. And the erythrocytic part is something that has an early origin all the way back to 2001 or so, and then has eventually worked its way through in this analysis of this condition that is called Morgellons.
So when it hits moisture? I mean, if, for
that
example,
that it would reconstitute it?
Yeah, what would reconstitute it?
Okay, let's take it from the beginning there. First of all, when I first saw these forms, they were about 4 microns in diameter, roughly. A human blood cell is roughly 6 to 8 microns. These were roughly 4 microns in diameter, but the concave structure could still be seen. The first time I started working with those cells, I did put them in water, and then I noticed that they would basically break up and erupt and break all down, and that was a real interesting question to me because I didn't exactly know why. And then you will learn that red blood cells will actually do exactly that if they're in clean water, because there's an osmotic balance that needs to be maintained, and that pressure and chemical balance is out of whack with regular water, and so they'll break down and erupt. At that point, I started making some changes, and I made put a little bit of salt in the water and created the saline environment, thinking this is just an idea at this point, that the human condition is requires that, basically. And I found that these cells reconstituted in a very uniform way, did not have that problem of breaking up, and I was able to get much better photographs of them. And they would reach a full size, and that size would match, human cells. Again, I'm not saying they're human,
right,
but they would match perfectly. And then you'll find control photographs that I put up there of human cells, this type of thing. Then you had work eventually which got into some forensic level tests, because visual is real important and it's a big part of things, but I'd like to go further, and I probably spent 3 months on developing and using some forensic tests to determine whether or not it passed the test for blood. And there's a couple of those I worked on, and those are all recorded on the site, and it passed those tests. It's the best I can say. So that's one way. I noticed also as I was looking at these structures that sometimes they were subjected to boiling water, and they were not harmed. They were not harmed at that point when I saw one of the cases. I saw them through a process called electrostatic precipitation. This is where you collect things by introducing high voltage into a chamber. It's a process of air purification, so I developed a chamber for that. That's the first time I saw these, and I'd collect them on glass slides. I then started working with rainwater, and I had boiling water, to condense it down, and I saw them within that water, and that really surprised me. But then you started noticing that very hostile environmental conditions, what you normally think would destroy any kind of biology, was not destroying these particular structures. So
they're amazingly hardy.
Oh yeah, there's some. Well, yeah, it's even further than that. I mean, I've gone through a lot of chemical things. The only way that I can, so far that I've been able to break down these filaments, is with lye, sodium hydroxide, lye and heat. Sometimes I discover things in retrospect. I discovered this by trial and error with, a lot of work in between. Eventually, if you read in the biochemistry books, you'll find that that's exactly a very, very known way to break down that protein structure, like I was talking about, that encasing structure.
Uh-huh.
If you want to start testing for proteins, that's breaking down with lye and heat would be two of the best ways you can do that.
Well, it's fair to say that between, what we described under environmental modification, what you're describing under biological operations, that whatever is being sprayed can be very harmful to living things, including humans. I mean,
well,
we know that from looking at people struggling with Morgellons.
Yes, absolutely. And this Morgellon subject gets a lot more uncomfortable than most people want to realize, as somebody called me the reluctant messenger, the other day in an email, and I have to say he's right, because what
right.
I say is not popular. But the criteria or conditions that I associate or would use to establish the existence of this condition are not what most people would use. Most people use the skin, the presence of these filaments on the skin, as the criteria for whether this condition exists or not. I do not believe that that is at all sufficient, and that what is happening internal to the body is a more accurate representation of the state of affairs. And in particular, the presence of internal filaments internal to the body, alterations in the condition of the blood, and lastly, the one I'm looking at now in addition to that is the state of pH state, the acid alkaline state of the body. But particularly with reference to those first two, an internal presence of a filament and the alteration of blood cells, these are the criteria that I would use.
Right. And one of the things you focused a lot of effort on is the importance of keeping your body alkaline, not acidic.
That is what is developing, again, as a result of the research. My work is such that I am doing a great deal of culture work. I do, again, it's not a matter of what I believe, I do think that the evidence shows that I am able to culture the very entities that we are speaking of, to get them outside of the body and culture them in a controlled environment. I have done that now for a couple of years, and this is where my studies our focus is in these culture dishes. It's an ugly thing, you know, sorry to say it. It has these four stages of growth. It's not a pretty sight in terms of what's going on there, but it's certainly a much better environment to study it. As a result of studying that in these culture dishes, a conclusion, or we can call it more of a hypothesis, that it seems to be bearing some level of fruit. And first we can make a statement, and that would be that most biological processes take place within a specific pH range. That's actually an incredibly powerful statement when we realize
right.
what that's saying, because it's saying it's very focused. Things just don't happen by chance. It has a particular state of affairs of acid or alkaline for it to happen to begin with. And
right.
the culture that I'm working with has that same property, it appears. And it's growing in a very acidic. We do know that this particular culture that I'm working with flourishes in an acidic environment. We know that much. So you can present as just a hypothesis. So again, time will bear out whether it's true, but the hypothesis would be change the environment. Okay? If you know that the biology is usually related to the pH, then change that environment. And that change would then logically shift over to the alkaline side. And then along with that, one would start studying the impact upon health of an acid or alkaline state upon the body, and then that's a process of discovery and education for me, a very quick one over this last 3 to 6 months now, but that the effects of acidity on the body are pretty well established in terms of promulgating disease,
right.
And not a good thing. And I simply really was not aware of this really deep level significance of that. And so, but one has to look at what would be the impact here, and one finds that sort of parallel in support of one another, that there's two reasons for doing this. One would be that the general research indicates that just shifting your body over to an alkaline state is more likely to be beneficial from a health standpoint. That's not coming from me. And then the second would be that since we have knowledge this material grows in an acidic environment, in which many diseases do, it gives me another incentive to shift over to an alkaline state. And that's a big focus of the research right now, is trying to shift that over. The difficulty is doing that in the culture environment, doing that in the human body are somewhat different, but I'm,
right.
I'm trying the best that I can. So that would certainly be one, shifting it over to the, you know, now we're talking about what are some of the hopeful fruits of this research over the last dozen years, and hopefully it's not all, leading to a course of despair for folks, and I hope not, because personally I find this research over this last 6 months extremely promising and needs a great deal of extension and support. But the second aspect of the improvement that is being hypothesized would be the introduction of significant amounts of antioxidants into the
right.
body. It's these two things together which I would offer to the public as the most promising lead of research that I can provide at this stage to this so-called Morgellons conundrum. Now, the unfortunate reality, which is I was alluding to earlier, of the reluctant messenger, which people may not want to hear this, but I'm sorry. I speak what I find and what I see. And I mentioned what my criteria were for determining the existence of this condition, and it's primarily internal to the body, not external. And the unfortunate reality is that anyone, and that's roughly about 30 people now, coming as far away as China, but basically you could regard it as a reasonably random selection of individuals from across the nation and or across the globe that have participated in a, call it a test or a study to see whether or not these changes internal to the body exist. The fact is that every single one of them does. Every single one of them shows this alteration internal to the body and the presence of these filaments, and it's rather shocking to most people when they see it. Most people don't want to know about it after they learn about it. But my contention, which most people do not want to hear, but I simply go by the results of the evidence, is that the evidence indicates that the general population is affected by this condition, not a select
group. Right, so it's
group.
Not just the environment that's being modified, it's our physiology that's being modified.
Absolutely. Across the board thus far, if you think about it,
it's the modification of all life.
Yes, that's right. And the environment is certainly what is showing up. You know, I have done some tests. It's early, but I have some tests done on some animal blood that I was fortunate enough to get a hold of through a proper channel. I've done some very early study on foods that is just raising a lot of questions. But yes, we have to consider the potential alteration of this planet and all life that dwells on it. We must consider that as being a very viable impact from these.
Okay, now that brings us to my favorite topic, electromagnetic operations.
Okay.
And I know we described what HARP and cell towers were last time, but maybe if you could introduce what you mean by electromagnetic operations and also explain HARP and cell towers with it.
Yeah, I like to, you know, when you ask questions like this, what happens in my mind is I always try to go back to the source, you know, as to what inspired me to research a particular topic or to dig into it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they always have this origin that starts out as an idea, and then it starts to be tested, and then something usually intriguing is found, and then the testing just deepens and deepens. And then eventually is led to some type of composite or comprehensive picture of what seems to be the impact. That's the general flow of what happens on each of these seven topics we're talking about. And, you know, as we talked earlier today, I was trying to sort of recall, you know, what are all these papers I've done and when were they, you know? And and this atmospheric conductivity thing, the electromagnetics, that started also back in 2001. There was a lot of a physical analysis that took place in those early years, what I call early years relative to what's going on right now, at least the time period now. And so I started to look back at these dates, and they started back in 2001 is what I'm saying, and most of these went through 2005, this type of thing. Most of them looks like they went from 2004. But what happened here was that preceding the electromagnetic work was a great deal of environmental and chemical sampling that took place. And again, remember, this is always done as an individual, a citizen. There's no group. There's no proper, you know, funding or
resources. You're not providing alternative government. You don't have that funding.
No. It's just, you know, I do what I can, and most of it comes from my head, okay?
Uh-huh.
I mean, but there was a lot of chemical environmental sampling done based on sound logic, I believe. Everyone can decide for themselves. All those papers were there. And a certain set of physical alterations in the environment had been established by that time. And that included the presence of particulate matter, extremely fine particulate matter in the atmosphere. And I think we talked about this a little bit last time, but that particulate matter had also a particular class to it. And that was that they were metallic salts. And then the next level of determination would be that they are what are called ionizable metallic salts. And it's an eye-opener when you sort of discover these things and you say, okay, well, this is what I see. And then after that, you say, well, what does that mean? And this is a quite, you say, oh, well, this is the type of salt it is. And then you look it up and you say, what does it mean? And when you start saying ionizable metallic salt, it's just like it opens up this whole box, because now you start talking about energy. It's not just this salt. It's not just this physical thing. You now start introducing energy into the picture, because something that is ionized is electrically charged. And then I think we mentioned last time that the sun itself is sufficient to ionize certain classes of physical materials. And these are the types that I'm talking about. These metallic salts can be energized or electrified in a sense from the energy in the sun itself. And so that's an amazing physical property that opens up this huge door.
So it's gazillion particles that essentially have their own solar energy.
Well, they are able to carry a charge, an electrical charge, when exposed to sufficient energy. So, you know, that's where it starts. And then I remember that transition into the electromagnetic work, but I'm saying, okay, well, if that's the case, if this is the case, then what would we expect to change? And my first work, as I'm looking back at those papers, the first work had to do with the theory, the idea, the hypothesis that if this is all true, then one would expect the conductivity of the atmosphere to change. This would be a supposition I would make at that time. And so I made that supposition, and I started looking into this problem. And then I have to learn, well, how can I measure this? What do you do to measure this? And all these things are all in sight. This is what we could dig in for the hours and hours going over these papers. But I established ways to start measuring whether or not the conductivity of the atmosphere has changed. These started out with what's called a Van de Graaff generator. It's a, you know, those devices you put your hand on as a kid in a high school class and you made your hair stand on end? Yeah, well, that's how it started, okay? And these things generate a spark, and the length of that spark is related to the properties of the air that it's going through. And so I started that work, and if you find that something's unusual. And what's unusual is that it's not matching that which is supposed to be in all the books and all the science. And the only reason I can, only way I can account for that change is if the conductivity of the atmosphere has been altered. So that's the beginning that sets the stage for the subsequent work, that it does appear, indeed, something has changed here in the ability of the atmosphere to propagate energy. And so I don't know exactly when and how the idea came. I think the way this one came up is that there's always buzz, right? And people were certainly talking about HARP. HARP, you know, has received a lot of attention for, you know, probably 15 years or so, I would guess. Begich did his work, and so there's a lot of notoriety to it. And a lot of people will extrapolate to things and just immediately assume that it's true, and I just can't do that in my work. It might be interesting idea, but I just can't jump to the conclusion. But I remember a lot of people were talking about HARP and, you know, whether or not it was related. And when I first heard it, it's like, well, I don't know. You know, what is HARP? I have to start from ground zero. And so I start looking into it independently and objectively, not assuming anything.
And what is HARP? We need
HARP
to explain it again.
HARP is a high active auroral research program,
uh-huh.
Something like this. It's a claimed research project, primarily coordinated through the Air Force. Up in Gakona, Alaska is where the facility was built. It was built there for a very specific reason in terms of the magnetic layout, the magnetic field of the Earth. And it's a project which is claimed to be for scientific research properties to study the atmosphere and basically the impact of introducing energy into the atmosphere and the magnetic field of the Earth. And if one introduces that energy, how might we be able to do things, particularly with weapons systems and or communication, navigation. We're talking about weather. I have this patent out in front of me because I've learned to read it. It's really, it's not bedtime reading for most people, but I'll tell you, it's really been insightful to read this patent. You know, we're talking about weather modification earlier. I mean, Listen to this is right out. This is one line. We could spend all night on this HARP patent, but here's one line out of it. You know, if somebody asks, you know, is it relevant what you're talking about tonight? Is this relevant? And the question here is weather modification relevant to the HEART project? This is one line out of it. You know, weather modification is possible by, for example, altering upper atmosphere wind patterns or altering a solar absorption patterns by contracting one or more plumes of atmospheric particles which will act as a lens or a focusing device. I mean, this thing is laden with it, everything that we're talking about. Now, another clarification that probably should be made is that this particular patent, you know, it's not going to have HEART written on it. A patent is an idea. All I can say is that this blueprint, this patent acts as a perfect blueprint to what the HEART facility is and does. I'll say that. Because all of these things we're talking about in the electromagnetic side are instilled within this document, which, you know, it all has a number here. It's, well, we can find, if you want, it's a long number, but it's out there. It's pretty common. But, anyway, I start studying what HARP is about, and then I start seeing that HARP has a very, strong interest in the use of ELF waves, extremely low frequency waves. Two ways. HARP has an interest in radio frequency waves. They create a lot of heat and energy when you pump them into the atmosphere. And they also have an interest in ELF propagation. And that mostly has to do with submarines and or communication, because ELF was known to be good for long-distance communication, submarines, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's embedded in there. And I took an interest in this ELF aspect. It wasn't just in response to claims that were made, but I suppose I wanted to settle in my mind. If people are raising this question, is there any basis for what they're saying? Or is it just more internet buzz? And so I looked into it, and it becomes extremely fascinating. And I have to say, to get to the true heart of this, the only way that I actually got there was to take the time to understand and read this patent. I could do all that I wanted, okay, in terms of the general lingo about this thing. But I started reading this particular document where it described in detail, and I started to see this overlap that was just tremendous. Okay. I had spent probably 4 years or more trying to determine whether or not there was unusual levels of barium in the atmosphere. I never could get a lab to do the test. Nobody ever offered to do the test. It took me 4 years to just keep working on it, working on every time. I would say, yep, it keeps looking like it is. Yep, it keeps looking like it is. And in the end, you'll see, I said, you know, it's it, the best I can see. Take a look at this patent from Eastland, and you'll find within the first few paragraphs, it'll say, it has been proposed to release large clouds of barium, you know, in the magnetosphere so that photoionization will increase the cold plasma density. You know, that's techno talk, but it's exactly what you and I are saying tonight.
Right.
And that is this whole business about sunlight electrically charging certain classes of materials. Well, I had done the work first, you see, that said that this is what I find. I did not know these technical principles of HARP. I didn't, and I never would unless I would study this document. And then I read the document, and I see these things coming out over and over and over across the board. It would be very, very hard for me to state that there would be no relationship between the technology of HARP and the results of this research that we're talking about. They seem intimately connected in many, many ways.
And do you think the cell towers are connected?
The cell towers, I don't have anything on. I just don't. You have the emergency ground network, that, you know, that's a VLF, ELF system, and that could have some more relevant work to what I have done. But in particular, the cell phone towers, I don't have anything on that in terms of any particulars. You're getting in the microwave range for that.
Right.
That's a whole different set of frequencies. Generally not very, you know, the ELF stuff basically can cover the whole planet. This micro stuff is short distance, but high intensity, you know, creates heat, and they're creating weapon systems out of it. I'm not saying it's not a factor. I'm just saying I have no studies or information. And by the same token, when I see people claiming that it does, I keep looking for the studies. Okay. I keep saying, all right, if you're saying this is it, then give me something. And
right.
I'm just saying at this point, I don't have it. I'm not saying it's not there. I just don't have it at this level. To relate to the work that I have done, I just don't. But by the way,
it certainly looks from what you know, and this is what I believe, is that there is a very significant effort to understand, manage, manipulate the electromagnetic field for a variety of different applications. It's, you know, it's
across
certainly not just one thing.
Across the board.
Right.
Absolutely.
And when you do that, you can in essence, manipulate all life at a very, you know, at a very, granular level.
You know, as a point of interest on the Institute, this is one of the things that I put down. It's like, I would actually like to know. One of the functions that I would like the Institute to become involved in eventually is settling that question of cell phone towers. I know there's a lot of people, state and claim sensitivities. I list that as a goal. It's just that's another whole arena to get into.
Right. One of the reasons I got interested in it is I went through a period where I was driving hundreds of thousands of miles around the country. And once a month I drove from western Tennessee up to Washington and Philadelphia, and I would cross all of Tennessee and into Virginia on Interstate 40. And I had a cell phone in the major cell phone provider in that region. And it was a period when they were putting up a very large number of cell towers. You know, they were sort of on an ambitious building program. And I would drive by cell tower after cell tower, and my cell service would never work. And, you know, I started to wonder, you know, what is this about? And I had one of the members of our network was a project manager and kept sending me emails saying, this makes no sense. They're having us put up cell towers in ways that have nothing to do with the economics of the cell business. This is all very irrational. And then, and coming into August 2001, it was it was just an unbelievably ambitious building program. And then he called me in August 2001 and he said, we've all been fired, it's all stopped. And I said, you know, I think something big is about to happen. And that was what first got me asking the question, you know, do these towers have another purpose other than just cell phone service?
Right, right. You know, and I do not know. I am curious about that as many other things. Certainly, you know, the microwave world, the whole weapon system, that's something I haven't been involved in, but I know it's there. If you look into energy weapons and you know, the so-called non-lethal things, you know, microwaves are terrible in terms of what they do. They basically burn you without killing you. You know, it's bad news.
Has anyone looked at
cell phone towers? I just can't.
Any researchers that you're working with have looked at the question of what's happening to the honeybees and whether it's related to any, you know, whether it's the environmental or the biological or the electromagnetic, if there's any connection with their disappearance with all the different things we're talking about, including harm.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that we have to acknowledge, whether we call it fortunate or just reality, I don't know, but there is no network of organized research.
Right.
Unfortunately, there just isn't. You know, there is no body to coordinate or present this information. You know, when we learn about an EPA as kids, right, you have this agency called Environmental Protection Agency. You have this place which you envision that, you know, these kind of things, isn't that where they would do such things? You know, isn't there this place where there's some massive oversight and government takes care of us, right? And
see, now, I worked in government, Clifford, so I don't expect them to do any of those things.
It doesn't happen, right?
Part of you that's still hoping that...
yeah, it doesn't happen. So where is it coming from? You know, I don't have... That can become for a lot of reasons, but the truth is I'm making a living with most of my time. There is no master grand plan. And with respect to the honeybees, you know, you hear and know of these environmental impacts that are huge. They're just huge. And it's the same thing that we talked about before. It's this news item. It's this news item like a budget. And in the general consciousness, it's here and it's gone. And people, you know, the people that raise bees know how important, but the general population just doesn't get it. What we do know is that certain species on the earth are sensitive species, right? And act as a canary in the gold mine. And we know that the bee is one of these, okay? The salamander is another. We have certain sensitive species. And it would only make sense that if you had an impact upon the sensitive species, frogs or whatever, upon the planet, you would think that there would be tremendous interest in getting to the heart and nature of that problem because that's your early warning system. But, you know, your question to me, is there anyone that has established whether is there any linkage? Absolutely not, as with 3,000 other things that I can mention.
Right.
But I love the questions and I love the ideas because it's what obviously should be done. And the more that we keep asking it, the more I hope people realize that the reason the question is being asked is because it's important and it may be relevant.
One of the things when I look at your work and as I read your work, I keep thinking about the fact that you're talking about an input. If you look at a human body or a community as the living being, and you're talking about inputs, and in my mind, I'm thinking of how they combine with other inputs. So in the 70s, we started to introduce a significant amount of, fructose corn syrup into the diet, and we started to put fluoride into the water. And if you look at what you're saying about, you know, keeping the body alkaline, not acid, and the antioxidants, you know, it's really a Molotov cocktail when you look at these different things combined within a human body. And you don't see how, what a cocktail it is unless you start to really integrate them.
It is a system, right? Our
right.
whole existence. Our whole existence is a system. And I do believe, you know, the macro view is helpful, that you're not going anywhere without the big view first. And it gets incredibly complex. But if you have a good sense of that macro view of things, it's going to usually help you and guide you as you dig into those details. But, you know, the system, it's just astounding. And in many ways, I suppose it's overwhelming because we act like we're in control of the system, that system being the entire planet and everything that acts within it and upon it. We try to act like we're in control of it, and the reality is we're becoming our own victim of it.
Right. Well, let's go into one of my favorite topics, military applications.
Yeah, and I hope we covered the electromagnetic one. I mean, there's more there. As we talked about the weather thing, and I mentioned about three or four. What I'll do is I'll mention three or four main factors on the electromagnetic, which just sort of encapsulate the topics we're talking about. And they set the stage for additional research if people would like to pursue that. I see that I probably have about, 40 to 50 papers on that subject when I really dug into the ELF thing. And that was a little bit unsaid here, the amount of work that was devoted towards that and a potential impact upon the body. So maybe we'll spend another minute if you'd like, but the main categories
uh-huh.
would be alteration of the conductivity and therefore the electrical nature of the atmosphere in general, not just the shell at the top called the ionosphere, which is what, you know, HARP has claimed to have an interest in, but the consideration that the very atmosphere, the entire envelope of the atmosphere, which is actually incredibly delicate, by the way, three quarters of the mass of the atmosphere is contained in a layer of 7 miles thick. So when you go down and drive down to the grocery store, that type of distance is encompassing three quarters of all the mass of the atmosphere, which allows you to be alive and for everything on this planet to exist. So it's incredibly fragile, number one, and it is physically possible to modify it because it's not as big as you think it is. It's an eggshell around us. So that would be one, alteration of that. The second would be the consideration of the role of ions in weather. You have a normal state of affairs in electrical charges in this planet that act as a regulating system. It acts as a regulating system for weather. It acts as our existence depends upon the magnetic field of the Earth. Okay,
mm-hmm.
We are here because of the magnetic field of the Earth. Magnetic and electrical fields interact, and therefore it is important that balance exist in a relatively natural state for life to continue to exist in a natural state. The work that I have done indicates that we have a very directional and strong imbalance in that ionic relationship of the atmosphere. And we can extend that into, I wish that we have this mindset that would go beyond human beings, but that's just what we are and we seem to understand.
Uh-huh.
But you know, the ionic balance within your body is very important towards regulating your health. And so if that ionic balance is disturbed, you expect to have corresponding problems with health. And I'll give you one example. When I started doing research on asthma and allergies, which seem to come out in preponderance now, after these changes in the atmosphere were noted, I started looking into effects of allergies and source of allergies, and it's quite interesting, but the research that I found indicates that a major cause or source of the allergic or the asthmatic response is that of ionic imbalance within the body.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. And so what I'm doing is I'm drawing, let's call it relationships of interest that listeners might care to follow through in more depth. But everything that I'm talking about has some form of measurement basis behind it that is documented, and it's all there to show you what I did the best I can. And I basically was measuring ions for, you know, a year or two. And it does appear to be out of balance from all the work that I've done. The third would be this this what I would call ambient presence surrounding us, surrounding presence of ELF or extremely low frequency radiation and energy that I cannot account for in any natural sense at all. And this is extending our conversation a little bit on the electromagnetic, but I think it's important again as a field for people to be aware of. And let's talk about the beginning of this. An ELF wave is a wave that the wavelength is very, very long, and they can basically circumscribe the Earth if they're big enough. Some of us may have heard of what's called a Schumann frequency or Schumann resonance, and it's at about 8 hertz is what it is. And if you look at where this thing comes from, it's basically the fundamental resonant frequency of the Earth itself. And it is actually determined by that physical size of the Earth. It's quite fascinating. But everything that has a dimension has a wave that would resonate with it. And the Earth itself has such a wave, and it's a Schumann resonance at about 8 hertz. Well, I did some work that started to investigate. It was part of the analysis of whether a harp and such might play a role here, as to whether or not ELF waves exist around us. Because, again, it was a claim, and I need to know if there's any basis for it. It's very difficult, I would say, to measure that type of thing. It's not really easy. You just can't go down and buy something that measures ELF. So I had to dig into, you know, all the circuitry and engineering of this thing to design a circuit to try and do this with help. You know, I usually get an idea from someone, and I usually have to take it and modify it for what I'm doing. But I created devices and contraptions to measure this. And it was a big surprise to me because I'm always trying to eliminate let's say interference or problems. I don't want things to be a certain way. I'm trying to eliminate them. But if it keeps hitting me in the face, eventually I'll acknowledge it. And what was happening was that no matter what I was doing, I kept seeing the presence of these frequencies show up that they made no sense to me because the number was very low. Basically it starts out at 4 hertz. Now, here's where the conflict comes. And that is, if the Earth itself, it's the biggest thing we know of here, right?
Right.
We don't have anything bigger than the Earth.
Right.
And the fundamental frequency of that is 8 hertz. The only way you can have a lower frequency, like a lower number, is to have a bigger object. And here I am seeing this lower number. I'm seeing this thing of 4 hertz, half the 8 hertz roughly. I'm seeing this show up over and over and over, and I'm starting to ask, well, where is it coming from? Because you know, it's not even, you're not even supposed to be able to detect the Schumann resonant very. That's not an easy thing to do. And here
right.
I am building these things, and I'm finding this frequency over and over and over, which is less than the Schumann resonant. And I have to start asking, where is it coming from? And then I have to do the measurements over and over and over. And I would say that over a period of several years, I just did it over and over and over, and I kept trying to, I'm saying, is there any way that could be interference? And I would drive out to the most, and go out, whatever it was, to the most remote locations I could find. I would look for the most electrically pure areas. You know, New Mexico has some good spots for that, actually. But I mean, as free as what you would call from electromagnetic pollution as I could possibly find. And I would conduct these experiments. And no matter what I did and wherever I went, I kept finding this frequency of 4 hertz and then the multiples of it. 4 hertz, 8 hertz, 12 hertz, 16, 20, and they'd stop about 24. My equipment would knock out there. They're all on the site, but again, I would say this is what I'm finding. Well, I came to the conclusion eventually that this is here, whether I know why. It seems to be here, and this is what I'm finding. And then I start to learn into, well, if it's there, what's the impact of that? And then I start learning about the human body and the human mind. And I learn that the human mind functions at these very frequencies we're talking about. This is where the body works with respect to certainly mental functions. Not only that, there's biochemical things that happen too, what they call cyclotronic resonance. But I'm faced with this situation of the continued and repeated detection of what I would call ambient, continuous, I did it over several years, ELF frequencies that have no known origin other than some source. And what could the source...
Right, and that has to be having an impact. I mean, if you look at how birds or animals navigate using the electromagnetic field, I mean, essentially, we're sort of, you know, we're swarmers like the bees and the livestock, and so it has to be impacting all of us.
We are tuned in, whether we like it or not. We are,
right.
We are tuned in to this. And furthermore, I then got to the stage in the work where I tried to determine where it was coming from. And that was an interesting problem because you're talking about something which is very big, okay? I mean, the
right.
waves are basically greater than the size of the Earth. So where would they come from? So I started working with antennas and developing different types of antennas and orientations and all this type of stuff, and we get to cut to just the short end of it. But the end conclusion from that work was that the most likely explanation for the source of these ELF waves that I was detecting is literally the magnetic field of the Earth. This is a conclusion I came to, and people can go through that and see if they believe I'm right or not or why. But that was my conclusion. And then you start asking, well, how can that be? What is it that would send ELF waves using the magnetic field of the Earth? And, you know, if we had another 45 seconds, I would find it. But basically, there's a direct quote you can pull from this Eastland patent on the HARP subject that we're talking about.
Right.
Which says exactly that the magnetic field can be used to propagate this ELF energy, okay? And again, I came to it it was after I did this work that I
right.
read this in the
which
past.
Can very much manipulate how people feel.
Yeah, and possibly even, that's right, maybe
possibly
beyond
even
feel,
what they
maybe,
think.
Maybe beyond think.
Right.
And you know, if people, this is more on the anecdotal side, but I'll go ahead and mention it because we happen to be getting into this topic tonight, and that's fine because, you know, you had expressed an interest in it also. But I'll mention an anecdotal, a little bit, it's not exactly customary of me and my work, but it is what I did, and I wrote the reports on it. I put it up there because, again, it's a stepping stone to ask whether or not something could be happening. But I basically, I developed the circuitry to detect this energy. I determined to the best of my ability where it was coming from. And then I did something a little unusual. Now, some people might laugh at this or laugh at me, but, you know, I don't care. I did it because I thought it was appropriate. I put myself in that circuit, okay? Now, when you're talking about this type of energy, it's not like there is any current. You know, there's nothing
mm-hmm.
you feel at all. You can't feel anything. But I can only see it on the meters. But I put myself into that circuit. You could call it by holding the electrodes or whatever, or putting around my brain. But I will say, and this is anecdotal, but I did this for about an hour or two, and all I can say, I can say that it certainly appeared to create a very agitated emotional state. I think that's fair. And I'm allowed to speak from the personal point of view. That's all it is here. I'm not extending beyond anyone else. I'm just saying this was my experience. It was, and I don't get headaches and that kind of stuff. It felt noticeably different in terms of the mental state. And then I tried to be fair and ask whether or not I'm imagining anything or not. And so I let it sit, and about 3 months later, I did it again one more time, and the same thing happened again, and I wrote these papers on this. One of them's called, The Earth is the Antenna. We'd have to dig them up. But the same thing happened again, and all I can say is I never did it again. It was like...
too ugly.
I was just, this is something, I'm not making a big deal out of this. I'm not saying it's the inline or anything.
Yeah,
This is what I did, and this is what happened.
Yeah,
say again, Catherine.
If you look at the behavior, one of the things I've noticed, just driving around so much as I do, how when the spraying started and HARP started, those two things started, all the animals got tired. You know, you're watching livestock all over the country, horses, cattle, and they're all exhausted all the time. Now, you know, they don't run around the field the way they used to. You know, there's something going on, and you don't know what it is, but it's not, the behavior of the animals is not natural.
You know, it's a great observation. I mean, these things are interesting to me. You know, those people, I have a background in the scientific world, but I'll tell you, science is not everything, okay? And you can play games with science forever.
Right.
And when people offer observations like this, There are those that will discount anything that's being said just because you don't have your little regimen of your little study in front of them in a way that's palatable for them. But when observations are made like this about people that, I mean, they're looking seriously. This is not something just casual. They are observant and they notice something significant. I would say register it, you know?
Right.
Take it, and you don't have to cast a verdict on it.
Right, that's why it's so important we keep asking questions, because if we all, you know, we don't try and come to conclusions, we just ask questions. You know, enough people share their different pieces of the jigsaw puzzle and you start to see patterns emerge. We have a question I wanted to see. You may not know the answer. Two people from Fairfax, California asked, what about the MERA communication system that was put up in Marin at the cost of millions to the general public by Motorola? Many locals complained that it was a hugely costly program that was overkill, never has functioned as it was supposed to. And a second one, have you looked at the report by Jim Phillips, The Science of Air Pharmacology or Chemtrails? What did you think of it?
Well, let's see. The first one I know absolutely nothing about.
Is MERA one of the Gwen Tower?
What? Oh, I know something about the Gwen Tower. That's the emergency network. But I don't know about this specific program or installation in any way. So we ought to make sure, I guess I need to be clear on the question, but I'm not aware of any particulars with respect to that particular program. I'm aware of the GWEN network, ground, emergency network.
Right.
I forget what the wide area emergency network or something like this, which I believe is in the VLF range, not the ELF range. I could be mistaken, but I think it's one notch up above.
Uh-huh.
And the wavelengths will be a little bit shorter, but still the same idea is that it's, on the surface it's intended to be a communication system that will hold up in times of, emergency or catastrophe. And then there are, because of the long wavelength, can propagate for, cover large regions. And then there are those, I'm aware of the claims that there are those that think that that particular network, let's call it, has superimposed upon it, other information. And again, you're in that borderline of ELF and VLF, so that would be a question too. And at this point, I have to regard it, as a claim, and I'm aware of the idea, but again, until I have information, I can't do anything with it, and I have nothing. I will say that I've run around with my frequency monitors, at some of these towers, you know, trying to pick anything up. But the truth is you have to have the right meter. You have to know what you're looking for. And it's not that easy to construct a composite picture out of some kind of isolated view like that. So
the entertainment industry was just notified that some of the wireless microphones can no longer, they have to have their I don't even know what it's called, changed because those frequencies are now being reserved for the emergency radio networks.
Right, right. Yeah, I wish I could say more other than I'm aware of the claim.
Right.
But, you know, I don't have anything on it other than I spent 4 years, you know, measuring ELF frequency that I did document.
Did you know what this report by Jim Phillips is?
I think I recall this name. I was trying to look at this, if it's what I think it is. You know, I stray out of the personalities of things, but I think I'm aware of this article. I'd have to have the title of it. It must be Phelps. Yes, not Phillips, isn't it? Yeah, Phelps. How was it stated? Was it stated Phillips or?
Jim Phillips. It was stated Phillips.
Yeah, I know of Jim Phelps, Phelps, over the years, that has written an article, you know, on the quote chemtrail subject. I don't know if that's the same person we're talking about, but it sounds like it is because I don't know who else you would have with a name that similar. How would I say this? There are people that will write a paper. They will present a scenario and offer that scenario as an explanation for basically the big picture of everything that's happening. And, boy, you know, my work stands on its own. Let's just say, I guess I'll say it this way. If I felt there was sufficient merit and substantial information in such a document, in such a single document, to encompass everything that we're talking about, then I would.
It's hard to imagine we have enough information to do such a thing.
Pardon me?
It's hard to imagine we have enough information to do such a thing.
You know, this is years ago. There's this paper called Chemtrail Spraying in Our Sky, and I'm wondering if this is the one that he's talking about. And I'd have to bring it up again, but I remember looking through these papers. Anytime these things come up, I usually will read them. But I do not get the depth of information that I am seeking, and I usually find information which is conflicting in a major way, not a minor way,
right,
but conflicting in a major way with the work that I have done, and the confusion comes in the fact that it appears as though sometimes a part of the information appears to coincide reasonably well, but that there are so many contradictions that
right.
I have to often regard it as a potential intentional mix of information, which is not intended to be entirely truthful.
Right.
I don't know if
right.
that's fair.
And the way, you know, that is one of the ways you discredit good research is you mix it up with a lot of stuff that's not so good, and you kind of pull the whole thing down.
I've seen it many, many
right.
times, and I'm not making that statement here in particular. I'm just saying if I felt that it was something I could hang my hat on, I would probably be pursuing it further.
Well, we have to go to military applications because this is such the weaponry aspects of this to me are so important for what I'm doing. If you manage money and deal with basically personal wealth and questions of household finances, then, you know, much of what's happening in terms of the price of different assets and the behavior of different financial markets, I believe, is driven by invisible weaponry. So even though we don't necessarily have all the knowledge, I think it's really important to ask the questions about what really is holding the dollar up. And that comes back to military and comes back to these kind of weaponry. So I really want to talk about military applications.
You know, this
can we
country,
go there?
This country, yes, we can. you know, this country, its economic existence, unfortunately, is tied into a military economy. It's just, you know, in terms of what we produce and what our primary offering to the world is. Unfortunately, it has become dominated by an indulgence in the development of of weapon systems, and it's to the point where it dominates the economy, and it's very unfortunate. But I
right, well, we're spending about $1 trillion a year.
Yeah. You know, that's my own personal opinion, which I'm entitled to interject occasionally, right? But so.
Well, but what's happening in the financial system, Clifford, is we print paper, whether it's currency or treasury securities or Fannie and Freddie securities, and then we sell them all around the world, and people buy them, and then they go down in value. And that constant drop in value, that constant inflation, is a taxation system not working through the income statement, but through the balance statement. So we've created a global taxation system that is really financing the empire and a global empire, because we know as we do this, the military bases spread more and more, and the investment in military all around the world become greater and greater. And literally, the beauty of this taxation system is no legislature ever votes on it. It's sort of through the balance sheet behind the scenes and too complicated for most people to understand, although people like Ron Paul are starting to, you know, get a wider population educated about it. And for many, many years now, you know, I work a lot with people in the precious metals market, and they'll say, in 2005, I'll never forget, going to our big GATA conference, and everybody said, the price of gold is going to $2,500 this year. And I said, no, it's not. It's going down. And they looked at me like I was nuts, and it really came back to my assessment of the extent to which this whole global financial system depended on this invisible weaponry to force people globally to, you know, to take and hold dollars and U.S. dollar denominated securities. And so to me, there's nothing more important than trying to bring transparency to what we can, you know, start to glean about this invisible weaponry.
That's right. You know, and I'm not an economist by any means, but I have a very, very strong interest in the subject, and even more so over the last few years. And, you know, there is a point where that balance sheet breaks down if it's false. You know, and it might take a long time or longer than we think to discover it, but it's inevitable that it will break down at some point if it's based on false pretenses. In terms of the specifics, and I'm not offering any timeline there, by the way. You're the prognosticator there, but but I am interested in such topics, I'll say that.
Well, I think the point you make, which is a very good one, is the more we depend on force to make the fundamental finances of the system go, the more uneconomic and unproductive the system becomes.
And you get
this spiral down that requires either depopulation or reducing a huge portion of the population to poverty, or, you know, or worse. So
it's a false economy at some point. I mean, you have to produce. So, I mean, what is wealth?
Well, it's a liquidating economy.
You know?
It can, you know, it's liquidating the outsiders in a way that, you know, engorges the insiders. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, to do that depends on incredible control and force, which gets us back to, you know, can the electromagnetic field be manipulated? Is it being manipulated? And then what are the military applications of this kind of technologies?
Let's try to tie some of these together. And one thing we're seeing as we go, along here is that this list, even though I present it as seven items, right, seven line items, as we go along, there is no way that we will now not start to recognize that there are crossovers and links. There just are. And they become so enmeshed eventually that it becomes somewhat artificial to have these divisions. And this is why the problem, you know, the whole weather thing that has received so much attention is really a problem to me, because it's one out of seven, and that's only seven that I've identified, you know?
Right.
Who's to say what the others are that I haven't identified? But first we have to recognize that all these things we're talking about, they're linked, and they become increasingly linked the more we dig into it. And when we get to this military line item on here, you know, this is the point where we can start to see that everything we've talked about is a part of this military item. Because the
well, right, and one thing I want to step back and say is a point I made the last time. In my experience, if you look at the people who manage resources at a very high level, either domestically or globally, they and you look at an operation that spends as much money as this one does, in situations like that, they never have one purpose. You know, they're very good at 3-fers and 4-fers and 5-fers and prototyping and trying stuff. So my expectation is that whatever we're dealing with is not just one thing.
And that expectation fits because we can go through every one of these, and there are obvious military applications with every one of them, okay? And,
right.
You know, let's start stepping through them, okay? And these are just things that we either know or hear about, let alone the whole world we don't hear about or don't know anything about.
Right.
But if you start talking about environmental modification and control, the question is, are there any military applications to that? They're huge. This is, I mean, one of the many holy grails of a military. But you mean to tell me that if you can't control the, that you don't have an interest in controlling the environment? You can flood the
Well,
army.
Weather control is one of the most
army.
Powerful
you can
weapons.
The army.
Right. It's one of the most powerful weapons there are.
Absolutely is.
Right.
Okay. So there's no question about the military significance of that. The one that has received the public attention on this is the paper out there called Owning the Weather in 2005? Boy, time flies if that's true. I forget what their date was, but it's called Owning the Weather, okay? And it's one of the think tank papers, you know, it's always by a contractor. The military would never sign their name to it exactly, but the military sponsors the study. And the whole point of the article is basically to acknowledge in a public way that this is absolutely the goal of the military, is to completely control. And they will use the word dominate and control. They want to completely control the weather. And the whole thing about space, the same type of command desire exists and occurs for space, okay? And so this is a public document which we can all, you know, have for public eyes, released for public consumption. So it's like I don't think we have the necessity. First, it become tedious, and we just start spending a lot of time on research. But now from there on, you go into the particulars, okay? How would you actually do it? But tonight, we have time to make the point, and if somebody thinks the point is illogical, they can go on. But if you think it's valid, then it's one of the applications of the military, and I believe it's paramount here.
Weather control is one, but also electromagnetic weaponry and manipulation can also be a weapon.
All of these are so deeply entwined in this, and this is where
right.
the military thing comes from. Okay? At some point, somebody's going to have to make the user's guide to the Eastland patent and put this in regular English, you know, for folks. But, you know, it's like across the board if we read this stuff. It just blew my mind when I first really started digging into this. But they'll talk about the whole application on the military arena, okay, with communication disruption, communication enhancement, okay? They try it both ways. They want it both ways. They want to knock somebody out from talking, and they want to be able to talk on private channels, okay? Guidance.
Now, what about knocking planes and flying things out of the sky?
Yeah.
Disabling their electronic systems.
Energy weapons, okay?
Right.
I found a statement. You find tidbits. You find certain tantalizing references to the whole at certain points. And I remember finding this article about a local police. It was a company that had developed something for the police department. And what was it? It was something where it was sort of like no bullet, okay? It's this
it's a directed energy weapon.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of like equivalent like a flashlight type thing, and it shoots out energy, okay? It concentrates that energy in a plasma, okay, that whole electrically conductive gas thing we were talking about with a fluorescent tube, and it acts as a weapon without talking or without even
touching. You'll see, you know, congressmen skiing into trees or people having bike accidents or car accidents, and the patterns are very much directed energy weapons.
You know, that's a public invention
right.
out there. So just extend the principle, okay? Concentration of energy in a plasma is the principle. A plasma is an electrically conductive gas. This is one of the main tenets that I have established with this work, is it appears as though we have altered the atmosphere so that it is in a plasma state, however weak. Plasma has a density. But if you get any electrons in there, you're improving things. And if you can learn to concentrate energy within that plasma, this is what a directed energy weapon is. And there's no doubt in my mind that such systems are in existence or under development in ways that we can't even hardly imagine.
Now, how does this tie into the possibility that we can trigger earthquakes and volcano eruptions?
Well, we were talking, you know, I don't have an inside track, right? I have to rely on my mind and research and do the best I can to find out if something's plausible or not. So what are some things that we know? We talked about ELF waves, right? And we talked about the
right.
scale and size of them. You're talking about things that are the dimensions of the Earth. So you can certainly make things that have waves that are less than the dimension of the Earth, and you could develop basically any wavelength that you wanted to match whatever you wanted in terms of a regional aspect or all the way out to the globe and apparently beyond by what I found. So
right.
this tells us that at least the framework for generating this energy exists. It's in place. Now, what's another thing we know? We know that there is this field called tomography, and tomography is where they use this type of energy to try to map what's happening underground. Okay, and you get involved with it in geophysics and oil field and magnetic field studies, seismic anomalies, this type of thing, and guess what? weapon systems in the sense of seeking out. You know, the whole Afghanistan thing about, you know, finding people underground.
Right.
Okay, well, this is the type of thing you would use. That's the name of the field. I'm not an expert in the field, but it makes perfect sense to me because these types of waves penetrate the Earth. This is why they were used in submarines. They were the only way that you could communicate with a submarine, you know, hundreds of thousands of feet or whatever under the ocean because these waves would penetrate. Well, they penetrate the Earth. Now, I don't know how far we want to extrapolate that technology, but
right.
it is not hard for me to imagine that I could extend that technology to the point where it could have an impact at a seismic level. That is not beyond consideration to me at all.
In the last interview, we talked about the heave weapon.
We sure did.
Which is a patent, I think.
It's part of this. It's part of this Eastland patent.
It's part of the Eastland patent.
Yeah, let's get the title out there so people have it at least, because you know it's not going to say HARP at the top. The title of this patent is Method and Apparatus for Altering a Region in the Earth's Atmosphere, Ionosphere or Magnetosphere. That's the patent. It was written by Bernard Eastland in 1987, and the number's there. And basically. It is this whole idea of what we're talking about, okay?
Right.
And yes, again, now extending to scale. That's an extension of scale which is referenced explicitly in this patent. So, you know, we're not far-fetched with what we're talking about.
And a heave weapon is
This is a way, and again, I have to read it in the patent, I have to dig into it and understand this. I have to get these books on plasma
right.
physics and try to make sense of this. This is my interpretation of what I read. They make a reference to this thing in this patent about this thing called a heave weapon. And what you're actually doing is that you're building up energy. Like, imagine, you know, a resonant wave, right, where you hit things a certain amount of frequency and you like walking across the bridge, right? That was a great one. The soldiers walk across the bridge and they walk in time and the bridge broke down because they weren't breaking step, right? That's a famous case. So resonance is when you're amplifying that energy in a concentrated form at periodic intervals, right? So imagine these waves we're talking about, very long wavelength waves. Imagine like you could start to resonate with that wave, something going, you know, 2 times a second, 3 times a second, which is extremely slow when it goes to like electromagnetic radiation. But you could start to resonate with that, okay? And you could add a little bit of energy just at the right time to make it build up a little bit. And imagine you keep doing that and keep doing that and keep doing it. Well, the method that is inherent in this system that is designed is something that keeps doing this and building up at a global level until it is big enough to literally lift up the magnetic field of the Earth. Yeah, and it's a field. You know, I worked in physics and it's all conceptual, but it's there. It's this three-dimensional field. And to imagine somebody lifting up the magnetic field of the Earth and then slamming it back down on the Earth, that's what a heave weapon is. And the first time and the only place I've ever found a reference to this was in this patent. But I just imagined the energy that the guy was talking about here, because they're talking about in this patent energy which is on par and sufficient with nuclear bombs and the energy in huge storm systems. Okay, like the Hurricane Katrina thing, right? Imagine the energy that's in that. These are the types of systems that they're trying to develop. Not trying, I think we're past the trying stage, unfortunately, but that are actively being pursued is to, you know, human beings love to control whatever they can. And this heave weapon is mentioned there. Now, what I did, furthermore, is after I saw the idea in here, I dug in my books, and I actually dug into the physics and the math of this, and I said, is this really possible? And I dug into it, and I dug into it, and you'll find all these papers that lead to the determination that, you know, it does seem like it's possible. It seems like the amount of energy they're talking about, it's actually possible to do. And what I found was the key to it. Guess what the key was? And this sort of ties in with our earlier discussion, but guess what? The lower the frequency of that wave, the more the energy can be built up. And you remember how I was talking about this thing with 4 hertz as opposed to 8 hertz, like bigger than the Earth? All I know is that the lower the number went, if you look at the math of that, the lower the number on the frequency. So imagine the
more
biggest wave possible, the more energy you could build up. Obviously, it would take more time, and it would have to be all perfectly, you know, resonate and coordinated. But this is the type of system I can envision in my mind that would affect basically the geophysical aspect of big enough to affect the planet itself. And this is not just a pipe dream. I mean,
I want to just mention when I started to look at this, you know, because day to day my concern is how can people use their assets, you know, whether it's their time or their resources well. And I was in 2000, when was the tsunami? Was it 2004? It was right before the tsunami. Yeah, I think it was 2004. It was Christmas 2004. I had a client who wanted a world bond fund, and I really struggled to find one that I liked. And he ended up investing in two, and one had about 15% of its paper in Indonesian sovereign debt. And literally right after he invested in it, overnight there was huge insider trading and it dropped by 15%. Boom. There's no change in interest rates, nothing happening in the market. There was no explanation. We tried to talk to the sponsor, couldn't get a rational explanation. You know, everybody was kind of frozen, and I kept thinking, what is this? You know, there was no logic to it. And then literally days later, the tsunami happened. Mm-hmm. And my conclusion, I'm a very happy, optimistic person. I literally went into a depression for a week because I realized they knew. Mm-hmm. They knew there was going to be a tsunami. And so my question is, how in the world do you manage resources properly in a world where some people have that kind of inside information?
Right.
You're talking about, you know, you're talking about what Naomi Klein calls disaster capitalism and economic warfare on a scale that we've never been able to fathom before, which is what I believe is happening. And so that's when I said, okay, you know, how is it that the United States is able to persuade countries to do things which are completely irrational to their self-interest? Mm-hmm. And that's when I went down the, you know, down the pathway of really looking at HAARP and the invisible weaponry, because clearly, you know, we have, you know, the Empire has a force behind it, which is not in the popular, in the popular understanding.
Right, right. You know, how far do we go? You know, I have to ponder human nature all the time as I do this work, because you just have to ask how far can we go? And it just seems as though we're in this, you know, stage of human evolution where, you know, technology is the god. And there's no limit set as long as it appears to be achievable in some way from a technological standpoint, no matter what the costs are.
Right. In other words, you have a situation where anybody who has access to the technology is using it in a kind of out-of-control fashion.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk. Shall we go into global surveillance?
Yeah, what I can do. See, what happened there was we were also starting to pick up that planetary and geophysical modification.
Okay.
That was a part of what we just did.
Uh-huh.
I can mention another couple more sort of interesting studies that were done. And I see your time is on the downhill side, but those last two, they won't take very long.
Okay,
so
let's
maybe
do.
Maybe spend another 3 or 4 minutes on this geophysical thing.
Okay, great.
Now, this is a part, you know, if you look at this work, it has this progression, you know, and it starts with a photograph up in the sky, right?
Right.
It says, something looks wrong here, folks, what is it? And it's very sort of elementary and simple in terms of a question to pursue, whether or not something is unusual. And in the work, you know, develops and it goes through analyses and you get into all this environmental sampling and then you extend into regions and areas that, you know they're somewhat taboo, but you know that it has to be done because that seems to be what is and it opens up our eyes to things that maybe we'd rather not see, but we do it. And so we get this gradual understanding of the extent of what it is we're talking about. And it changes some people's lives as a result of that understanding. And that's sort of where we're at now, up through that whole point on the military, and then the planetary stuff sort of digs into that a little bit. At this point on, once you start getting to this planetary and geophysical stuff, you start getting into this, you know, more conceptual world that you don't know for sure that it's true, but you can see that it could be and that there are potential applications there. And it just becomes more conceptual. And we started out with the weapons, and those are somewhat tangible in that we can find a reference to them. But I had a line of research one time, and I will say it's fair to say that I had a source of information that said or claimed that something was happening on a geophysical level that involved the rotational speed of the Earth, okay? In other words, and here was the basic claim, that there are things happening on this planet that are leading to basically planetary and global change and catastrophe, basically, right, but chaos, and that human beings are doing the best they can or doing whatever they can to try and work around or circumvent these impending changes on a global scale.
And this is, for example, a pole shift?
Well, that type of thing, of that magnitude. And so something was presented to me, and it involved the rotational speed of the Earth. And I won't get real heavy into this other than, I had no assumptions at all. I was intrigued enough by the claim because of my own – we all have an intuition about us, right? And
mm-hmm.
And all I can say is life is not normal. We're not on this smooth path right now. On planet Earth.
The way I say it is, it just keeps getting weirder.
it does. And so, you know, we can follow our heart, but it's like we have some senses, and things are not smooth. And I took on the question. I simply asked the question, is it possible that what I'm looking at, because now I'm already at the point where I see, you know, it looks like it's possible to actually affect things at a geophysical level, a planet itself. Is it possible that the rotational speed of the Earth might be affected. And then you'd have to start asking why that's important, and we'd get into the discussions about the magnetic field of the Earth and the decline of that magnetic field, and that life only exists on this planet because of the magnetic field. And you brought up the pole shift, which is exactly that topic, and we won't have time to get into it. But nevertheless, it was a sufficient merit for me to engage the topic, and so I did. And the summary of this is that I started digging into databases, geophysical databases involving the magnetic field of the Earth and time. Time becomes a very interesting concept in itself, because it originally comes from the rotation of the Earth, right? This is where time comes from eventually. But then, as human beings go along, they create these atomic clocks, which are based on a whole different set of physics principles. And then the interesting things come about when you start to compare these two things and how are they changing. And so I got involved with that work, and I'll have to, you know, cut that shorter other than to say that in that research of these databases, I found some very unusual anomalies. And I don't like to make things, you know, the whole tease thing of making something sound conspiratorial. But it is interesting. These same databases that I'm talking about, after I had this information and dug into it, started reporting on it, those databases, they no longer became available. They were not available, okay? We can call it, they disappeared from view. But I did get some data from them, which was very, very interesting. And the data involved anomalies in the magnetic field of the Earth, the rate of decline of that magnetic field of the Earth, and remember that life itself is tied into this existence of the field. And then the third was differences between those two time accounting systems that I'm speaking of, one based on the astronomic basis, the rotational rate of the Earth, and the second being atomic clocks, cesium clocks. And I'll say that I found anomalies, and that intrigued me. And then I looked at whether or not it is actually possible that there might be geophysical applications of these operations to those fields of study. And I know this is vague, but we just have a few minutes to generalize. And all I'm saying is the work at some point got into this stage of more conceptual geophysical aspects, which are difficult to prove, but nevertheless, I would regard as very interesting, because they are suggestive. They are suggestive that the level and the scale at which we are speaking of with respect to these operations, we already know they're planetary in nature.
Right.
So there's sufficient merit in the arguments to examine other ways that the planet may be affected that are beyond our normal sphere of consideration, you know, in our daily lives, and may have to do with a much grander sense of the state of this planet. And I guess I would summarize it that way without going into details. I hope that gave some sense, though.
No, I think when you don't know what something is all about, you have to have a framework that incorporates any reasonable possibility, mm-hmm. which this clearly is one.
Yeah, and it became very interesting, but it became, call it pretty heady work at that point, because you have this thing about intuition as well as high level in terms of depth of information databases that they're just not our normal common thing we're looking at.
Well, we now have 5 minutes to do both global surveillance systems.
Well, they'll be short and easy. but at the end, I was involved with things like determining time, you know, down to literally fractions of a second, and it was quite amazing. In terms of the methods that were used, I guess, relative to what I was trying to get at in terms of information. These last two are pretty simple. The second one, there's more to work with than the last one. The last one is more just an idea again. But here's what happened. You have this thing called radar. And we know that radar is a detection system and a surveillance system.
Mm-hmm.
And radar is based upon radio waves, and that's where the name came from. And I sort of started looking into this idea of radar and why it works, and it has to do with the wavelength. You know how we're talking about you match the wavelength to whatever it is you're working with? Well, the reason radar works is you match that wavelength to the size of the object that you're looking for. And radio waves happen to work real well with things like planes and ships and boats and that type of stuff, okay? And missiles and this type of, things of that size work real well with radio waves. And that's how radar was developed. And you're basically bouncing that wave off that object and you get a feedback from it and you know it's there or not there. Well, the question came up, and I forget exactly how it came up, but it did come up about the issue of a surveillance system. Is it possible? Is there the possibility of detection? We know these particles are in out there, and we know they're submicron in size, incredibly small. Is it not possible that you might want to have a system of detecting the presence and or location or movement of these particles? And if so, is it not possible that you might even seek a way that that could be done if these particles were in the human body? Is that not a proposal? And in my mind, yes, it is such a proposal.
Right. One of the questions I had wanted to ask you was, could the filaments be, in essence, antennas?
Well, as that question is posed, I can give a simple yes, that it's possible. You know, do we know? Maybe we don't know, but that's a little bit where this argument is going, except I'm actually even working this argument down to the submicron stage at a place we can't even begin to see, because there is an alternate method of detection and surveillance that doesn't use radio waves. It uses light waves, and it's called LIDAR. Just as they had radar for radio waves, there's something called LIDAR, and it uses light waves as the basis. And light waves are very, very small. They are the, you know how we talked about the other waves are the size of planes and ships? Well, the light waves are the size of these little bitty particles that we're talking about that are in the atmosphere. So it is certainly plausible that one, at least in principle, could develop some kind of system that would use that band of the electromagnetic spectrum for detection of extremely small particles as opposed to using radio for bigger things. That's the general idea. Now, as I had that notion and idea that such a thing is possible, I then did research to find out, is anybody actually talking about this? Well, there is a very interesting group called, I hope I have the name right, but it's called the American, something like American Federated Scientists, something to that effect, or American Federation of Scientists. And if you look at these folks, these are the folks that basically were the atomic bomb folks. This is the outgrowth of what is left of that industry and technology of creating the atomic bomb. These are the big defense guys. The big heady guys in the defense industry that developed that type of technology and the outgrowth of that. I found a paper by them, and all I'm saying was very interesting, because this group was stating, they were saying, what is the project that we think is of greatest need and benefit in our future that we could work on? And they were actually seemed somewhat of apologetic for their work in the nuclear industry. It's like they didn't seem like they were so keen on that anymore. But they were looking to the future. And you know what they said was the most exciting and important technological development for the defense industry to engage itself in? LIDAR.
Okay. Really?
A surveillance system based on LIDAR. Now, it's years ago that I found that paper, and I didn't put it actively in my site. I just remember reading it and go, wow, you know, I came to this conclusion based on the work, and these are the people that do such things, and they're saying they'd love to do this.
Now, okay. I have to push you because we have 1 minute for the detection of ions.
Yeah. Well, the last one is really simple. We don't even need to dwell on it anyway, other than with all that we've talked about today, there's also the case of whether or not you would have an interest in detecting disturbances in that plasma. If you have this electrified gas and something is moving around in it, maybe that you can't see by conventional means, but it's disturbing that plasma and you'd like to know about it. Is it possible you could do that? And it's simply my thinking that I would be very, very interested in being able to detect disturbances. You know,
right, and this goes to things like UFOs.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
Exotic propulsion systems and that type of thing. And it's a conceptual argument again, but it makes a lot of sense to me. But most of this, really the vast body of this work, it's not conceptual at all. It's based on arduous, tedious analytical work, documented and reported. But,
right, and I must say I really appreciate the detail that you have, you have drilled away at and nailed down, because I think it's made an enormous difference in our understanding of what this phenomena may be and you know, the details of what's going on. So we have 1 minute, and what I'd like you to do is describe how people can find you, support your work, support the Institute. I'd just like to say thanks to the support of our audience today. We're going to be making a contribution to the Kernicom Institute, and I would really encourage everyone else, if they're so moved, to do the same. If you could just tell people what you make the check out to Kernicom Institute, and where do you mail it, Clifford?
The address, Catherine, is P.O. Box 23721. 23721.
Okay. And it's up on your website, which we've linked to from the blog post.
Yes.
And I put up your links on the blog post, too.
That's in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the zip code is 87502. 87502.
Great. Can you give it one more time?
sure. It's Kernicom Institute at P.O. Box 23721. 23721, and that's in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the zip code there is 87502, and the research work is under my last name of Kernicom.com, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, and the institute is at KernicomInstitute.org, and we're a young organization that has a lot of ideas and ambitions and essentially no staff or resources. But that's what we're working onto, and our next main goal is to try and develop an international web-based conference to get this word out on an international level. That's what we're trying to do next.
Well, Clifford, this has been magnificent. I really, really appreciate it. I know many people in our network, we have a lot of people listening today, and then a lot will be listening to the MP3, and we'll have this in the podcast. But we appreciate it, and we'll do everything we can to get the word out and to keep helping you ask these really important questions. So have a wonderful evening. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Until tomorrow night with a regular Solari report, don't worry if there's a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.
I thank you for everything, Catherine.
Thank you, Clifford.
Yeah, thank you.